I'm very happy I've gotten the response I have here. Terry Fred, I said the same thing with his group. What's most fun about doing these things is the kind of response you get and the attention that people pay. I said at the beginning, and I just want to repeat it here, that I think it's much more fun to talk to this kind of audience because you're here because you want to be here and not because you paid, you know, $8,200, and you have to find out, you know, what the teacher wants for the, you know, by way of information for the test. And I'm very happy about that, and I hope that someday, you know, we can. I do adult forms. What I'm trying to say is, have speech, will travel. wasn't Bob Hope had something like that? I think it was have talks, will travel. That's what it was with this. But I'm afraid, since we don't have People's Express out from Minneapolis to Seattle yet, the travel expenses would be rather high. It's what is it, $79 from Minneapolis to New York? Well, I think it is. But then it's become, if you've been reading the things, it's become People's Distress. The airways, it hasn't worked out that well this summer. But I'm talking about these cut-rate airlines, like Freddie Laker, you remember, tried a couple of years ago. And they keep trying, but I'd be happy to, you know, to be a... and anybody's, you know, about form in the foreseeable future. Okay. For anybody who may not have been here before, I'm Erling Torsted from St. Olaf College, and the series we've been doing this week, I call it Newsworthy Americans, but they're basically Americans who have some sort of connection between American religious life and American political, and not so much with Schubert and a social life, but they have had a direct impact on American life. And they are all contemporary, they are all living, and therefore I think they are worthy of our consideration, because oftentimes our figures, the ones we've been talking about, are not only leaders, but they are mirrors at the same time. They mirror what we're interested in. They mirror or reflect what we want and who we look for. I have a theory, I can't prove it, but I have a theory, and I don't say this critically at all, that there are lots of other, for instance, potential religious or preacher-like candidates for the kind of prominence that somebody like Billy Graham has, for instance, or the prominence that somebody that Robert Schubert has, but they haven't been able really to find the right formula or put things together the way that you know, the general American public wants. Because what's happened, and I think it can be said with Graham and with Schubert, just to tie those two together, because you know, Reverend Moon, we had Wednesday as, or Thursday is way out in a different field altogether, and then Jackson and Reagan on Monday and Tuesday were totally different. But with Reagan and Schubert, is that they've been able to stand the test of time. I mean, there can be you know, political or in this case religious leaders who come forward. They might have a gimmick, they might have something that might be temporarily attractive, but then it fades. And it fades rather quickly because they don't mirror, they haven't anticipated some of the basic needs of the people. And what Graham has been able to do with his approach, and certainly it's true with Robert Schuller also, is to look at the American public and obviously not try to be all things to all people. We had a good talk with somebody I was walking out here with the other day, yesterday I think, about that you can't be all things to all people. And so like Graham, who has just the mass revival approach, and Schuller, who states, you know, from beginning, middle, and end, that he's reaching out for the unchurched. And he doesn't claim to have, you know, a theological seminary where they take care of everybody, you know, from beginning to end. But he's reaching out primarily for the unchurched, and his form of ministry is also, in that sense, specialized. And doesn't pretend, you know, to do anything more than what he does, at least on the TV programs in that sense. And so they, what I'm saying is with Graham and Schuller, is that they have found a need and have met it. I'm trying to think of, Schuller has a slogan on this one. If you find a hurt, what is that one? Heal it, I'm trying to, what is it? You remember that one? I used to know about five or six of what is it, inch by inch, growing a cinch or something. Something like that. I don't want to anticipate too far ahead of time what we're going to do. All right. Anyway, I'll save some of those a little bit later. And so I think one test really of the religious leaders, why they are important and why they influence our lives and why we respond to them, is that they have been able to understand really what at least a certain segment of the American population has been talking about or is interested in. And have been able to gear their programs accordingly. This is not to say that they are simply there by way of exploitation. Some people will sort of take public polls or samples of opinion And then whatever the people want, they'll gear their program accordingly. That isn't the case, I think it's true with both Graham and Schuler, is that they sort of defined rather early on in their preaching careers, you know, what they were going to preach, what their message was going to be. And obviously have had, as anybody has to in this day and age, with things like television, with computers, technology, generally speaking, you obviously have to, you know, retool from time to time to be able to do that. But I basically, I think the message is the same. So I'll go through this, and today again, I really need your input because I only have 7 pages, and so I'll, you know, as I said yesterday, I'll talk fast. But I really want your comments, and don't be afraid to disagree. I think I said the very first day, the worst thing for a speaker is simply to be ignored or for you to go away and say, well, he was pretty good. I'd much rather have you say he was full of beans than know why you say that, than just say, well, that was that, and the bus will come at 1:45. I've been here before, so. Okay, Robert Schuler, just some of you, I'm sure many of you know a great deal about or something about his background. He's an ordained minister in the Reformed Church of America. And in terms of background, that's the old Dutch Reformed that goes back and comes out of that great Dutch Reformed tradition in the state of Michigan with Grand Rapids, just like Minnesota, southern Minnesota at least, is Swedish and Norwegian. Holland, Michigan, southern Michigan is still very much Dutch in its ethnic orientation. He's a graduate of Hope College and of Western Theological Seminary of Holland, Michigan. He is an ordained minister in an established, that's important, in an established denomination. Because people invariably, and I'll maybe anticipate some of your comments here, people invariably compare Schuler to some of the other TV preachers, Pat Robertson, Jimmy Baker, Jimmy Swaggart, Jack Van Imp, some of the others, and they are comparable, or Jerry Falwell with Liberty Baptist in Virginia, but I think Schuler is comparable to those people only in the sense that he is also on television. Everything else, I think, as far as Schuler's program is concerned, is rather markedly different from that. Because Robertson and Swaggart and Baker and the rest don't try to speak for, nor do they even pretend to come out of an old established, you know, traditional kind of denomination. They are very much freelancers and aren't really held, in that sense, they have some freedom, and in that sense, I think they take a risk too, because they aren't held accountable to their particular denomination. And sometimes they can say some of the things, especially Jim Baker. I could get started on Jim Baker. I don't want to get started on that because, you know, God burning, pink tuxedo, and all those things. But they can get by with some things because they aren't accountable to a denomination. But Schuler, from the beginning, has put right up front his involvement with the Reformed Church of America. And I was going to ask you out here in the West Coast, do they sometimes, before and after the Schuler program, also list some of the other Reformed churches in that particular area, like Seattle or Portland or wherever it might be? Yeah, the Reformed Church is using the Schuler program for further information about. If you like Schuler's program, then here is a specific Reformed Church in America congregation. There are 5 or 6 in the Twin City areas, in Minneapolis and St. Paul. In other words, we talked a little bit about it yesterday with Graham. There is a referral system. They don't want you, in other words, Schuler doesn't want you just simply to sit there and watch, you know, Schuler in Minneapolis, St. Paul, 9:30 to 10:30 every Sunday morning. They want you to get out and get directly involved in a congregation. It's a referral system. And I think that's to be commended, because you don't really find that in Pat Robertson, and you don't really find that in Jim Baker and some of the others. They want all, I'll say it straight out, they want all the money coming into Virginia Beach, Virginia, or Charlotte, North Carolina, wherever it might be. lots of money is coming in there. Okay. Anyway, back to Schuler and the biography here. In 1955, he and his wife were sent by the Reformed Church to start a mission in Orange County, California. He likes to tell the story of driving out there. They had an organ in the trailer, a little pump organ in the trailer. His first services were held in a drive-in theater with a roof of a snack bar, for their pulpit. And the portable organ was used that he and his wife had been carrying around in their trailer. Today, this is the statistics I had were of 1983 from Voskill's biography here. The membership is over 10,000. It is the first walk-in, drive-in church in America. The church seats over 1,700 and is filled twice each Sunday and has seen on over 200 radio stations, television stations, I'm sorry, across the nation. Obviously, with this kind of following, with this kind of growth and all the rest, people are asking why. What is the reason for the success? And then also, we want to talk about that. How does he mirror some of the, the aspirations and the hopes and the needs of the American people? And then also, very frankly, because I think I'd like to get a discussion going, where are some of the areas where he's being, where there is, rather critical evaluation going on? And what seems to be some of what are some of the significant criticisms which are being made? With this kind of growth, people say, well, isn't it growing too fast? Granted that Orange County was one of the fastest growing suburbs in America for such a long period of time. But hasn't it been growing too fast? When you grow that fast, how can you have any kind of personal touch? How can you have, a small congregational kind of approach? Schumer answers by saying that what he does is necessary to, quote, impress the unchurched. That's the specialized ministry that I talked about before that he has. Developed very, very successfully. He states, very frankly, straight out, he states he's a showman. He's trying to get the world's attention. This doesn't bother him at all, the business about, the flashiness and all the rest that goes along with this. He makes no secret of his flair for a show business, and he does it, of course, in the land of movies and tinsel and make-believe. It's no accident that people would feel probably more at home with somebody like Schumer in the Los Angeles area than they would in, what should I say, Cleveland. You always pick on Cleveland. It's one of the less desirable places in America in which to live, with all due apologies to anybody from Cleveland here. I have to be careful. Remember when Gary Hart said that his wife could campaign in California, but he had to campaign in New Jersey? New Jersey, remember, was outraged over that. So anyway.
Sheboygan,
isn't that another one? That
Peoria.
Sounds kind of nice.
How's it play in Peoria?
How's it play in Peoria? Right. Okay, now, his prominence, that he has been really a national figure for 15 years, through the television and through the church growth ministries and the other programs, his prominence is established. So it's hard to know exactly where to start in what I would like to call this assessment of his ministry. He has many supporters, obviously, and he has few critics, at least critics in print. Most of the critics would say something like this. I'm using Voskill's book for a little bit of this. Some of the critics will say, well, it really is rather corny and schmaltzy, and his ministry, his theology seems to have a very low appreciation for the role of sin or evil in the world. But he does bring in people. They are in Crystal Cathedral. They're not in a saloon. They're not in the cathedral. I mean, they're not in a saloon or a casino. And no one else has been able to bring so many unchurched people into a church itself. Many critics have said, well, it's not for me, but if that's what you like, and then they'll let the rest of the sentence sort of go on with that sort of thing. And perhaps from my standpoint, it might be well just to let it go at that. That it's not my sort of cup of tea, but if it's what brings you into church and keeps you there, instead of being out on the golf course or wherever it might be on Sunday morning, maybe that's best. But obviously, I'm here, and I want to continue with this sort of approach. It raises questions. One last illustration I mentioned to a couple of you already. It raises another kind of approach for the local congregation. In our in Northfield, one of the Lutheran churches, of which there are four altogether, one of the Lutheran churches always started its services at 10:30. That was always it. 8:30 first service, and then fellowship and adult forum and Sunday school in between, coffee, and then 10:30 for second service. Well, after Schumer caught on, what happened was that the minister, Ed Meyer, began to notice that people were coming 5-10 minutes late, invariably, and this was at the Missouri church, and Missourians don't, like me yesterday, Missourians just don't come late to church. God wants people to be on time, especially through Missouri Synod. And suddenly, all these good Missourians were late. And it turned out they were watching Schumer right up to the last second and then making a last dash, rush to the church. And some people even gave up their favorite pews that they've been sitting for 15, 20 years. I remember, you could go on to that. How often do you move around, when you go to church? I sat behind, I don't want to get started. The fellow I sat behind had four dress shirts, and he alternated them, one every month. And then when there was a five Sunday month, he was in real trouble because he okay. he raises all kinds of questions. Just to sum up here, this he represents a very energetic and popular stream of religious thinking and doing in this thing we call Christianity in America. Now, he is controversial not just for his style, but for his theology. And I'd like to sort of move back and forth between both of those, not just for his style, but for his theology. And this is not criticism due to jealousy. I mean, the critics, and I'm going to be dealing with his critics here. This is criticism not due to jealousy, as some of his defenders have argued. Since everybody is willing to give Schuller the turf on which he stands alone, I mean, Schuller has not spawned a wide number of imitators, because that, especially since he's on national television, imagine anybody trying to imitate Robert Schuller. It simply doesn't work. Does anybody here, there's one in style, there's a little bit of approach from Prince of Peace, Lutheran in Burnsville. Was that anybody here from Prince of Peace with Thompson, Connie Thompson's son, in which he preaches both indoors and outdoors at the same time in the summer. And there are a couple of places, but basically nobody's tried to imitate Schuller. So they left him alone. Schuller himself, I have to say, if you're wondering here, never responds to his critics. So I have to simply go through Schuller's critics here and then invite your kind of response. It's like Billy Graham, I should say that also, never has responded to his critics. Some people say that's too bad, but once you start, then where do you end? Once you start replying to your critics, then it gets down to fine little nitpicking. And both have the idea of being affirmative and upfront, and what we say is really what we believe. Okay. Now, a number of early considerations here. One way to look at Schuller and his ministry, both his style and his theology, I think, is looking at him in contrast to Graham, is that he's sort of a pre-evangelist. There are no altar calls, at the cathedral. He's interested in attracting those who have been indifferent or even hostile to the organized church. This is where the thrust of the ministry goes, at least nationally. Schuller tells these people that the Christian faith is dynamic, that is subject to change, it's dynamic, it's moving ahead, it just doesn't sit there, it's accessible to everybody, and that it works. He poses, you remember, with open arms, an embracing smile, a spectacular building, it's friendship, it smiles, and it's upbeat. And that's one reason, I think, for his success and also for some of the criticism. Secondly, he shares this not only through the Sunday services, but through his Institute for Successful Church Leadership. 3 times a year, he invites several dozen ministers. Anybody have been into the Church Growth Institutes here? One. I'd be very happy to get your input as we go along on this one. The regular program for parish ministers to go out. Yeah, okay, I really welcome your comments on this, because almost all of them come back very impressed with what they've seen there. Not the least of which is that, I don't know if he's still done that, but for their adult Bible study, they use the Bethel series, which is a remarkable sort of thing, which shows how open they are. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, is there a regular congregation, or are these people always new that come every Sunday?
Who we had here 3 years ago when we had something on Schuller. We had Early Wold, who was the other Protestant minister in Orange County. And that's if you're wondering, Early is the husband of Marge Wold, but he's the one who has his famous neck. You remember, What Do You Want Me to Do, Lord, Break My Neck, that book that he wrote after he had his neck broken in surfing. And he talked about some of the other problems there. That's a little off the subject. No, most of these, not most, who knows how many are, unless they would have to take attendance or something, which they don't do. Many are new, but there is a solid core of the congregation which goes on and on. It's not just another tourist attraction. It's our week in Western Los Angeles, and Eastern Los Angeles, I'm sorry, okay. He shares this with others through the Institute for Successful Church Leadership. Several dozen ministers 3 times a year are invited to study what makes churches grow, not just his church, but churches generally speaking. They come back, as I suggested all before, impressed with his vision, hope, his energy. And Schuller gives them very practical ministry. It's not just a pep talk, but this whole matter of church growth, what makes churches grow. And that's a very lively subject. Many of you are parish pastors and deal with it every day. Okay. Third, he preaches that the church can grow only when there is a decided effort to attract the unchurched. He has proved in his particular kind of ministry that that's one place where there has to be a very strong and organized kind of outreach. And the statistics show that many of the unchurched do go, and many of the unchurched do watch his Sunday morning services. Okay, that sounds impressive, but it is, and some people would say, well, that's enough, why go beyond that? But it isn't really quite so simple. he has to come to terms with, and although, as I say, he doesn't answer his critics, he has to come to terms, I think, with the possibility that his emphasis on success is really not what the gospel is all about. That's a very important point that I would like to talk about in a little detail. To sure, God wants us all to be winners, to dream impossible dreams, to believe in success. And I quote him here because success really is at the core of the whole thing. Quotation. Success means discovering God's beautiful plan for your life and allowing it to develop to its fullest potential. That is possibility thinking, a self-help formula for success. It can work for us because it worked for him. Jesus is the super success of all times. I am not following a loser, I am following a winner. That's a close quote. But then the question becomes, what does he mean by success? And I use his definition here. Building, this is very important, building self-esteem in yourself and others through sacrificial service to God and to your fellow human beings. I'll read that again. Building self-esteem in yourself and others through sacrificial service to God and to your fellow human beings. That's a close quote. It is service which comes out of self-esteem. It is centered, to be sure, on the self. Do something good for yourself by doing something good for someone else. Then, of course, the question becomes, is this what the New Testament sort of understands, if you could use the term success, in this particular regard? Schuer doesn't get much more specific than that. And there are those who say that success is not in the New Testament to be understood in, you know, the terms of this world. Success is really to be interpreted higher. I'll be here. I was doing well there. Churches decided to have a joint service in Wanamingo, and one of the ministers was a classmate of mine and remembered that I had something in American history. So I went over, I was asked to preach, and it was about 95 already at 10 o'clock in the morning, and preached for a little while, and then I announced that I was leaving out three pages. And people afterwards said that was the best news they had had, or instead of the good news that they heard. The other kind of good news is that the sermon was about 10 minutes shorter, and so on. Anyway, we were talking about the New Testament and definitions of success. The words that you find in the New Testament really are such words as rejection, the suffering, cross, death, obedience. Obedience, where the rewards really are not those of what could be called, in today's psychological jargon, would be called self-esteem. When the Christians followed their faith, what happened to them? Obviously, they were persecuted for what they believed, and that's one of the criticisms which has been made. But still, it has to be argued, it has to be raised here. Are Schuer's ideas in the gospel really so far apart? Schuer's success orientation identifies success with those achievements which build esteem in self and others through sacrificial service. He has said both yes and maybe to the ideas of self-denial and a cross-bearing. The record here really isn't all that clear. But to Voskill here, success seems to be a means to self-esteem rather than a byproduct of obedience to God. That is, the argument could be put this way. The Christian should not be ultimately concerned with success or failure, but with doing the will of God. Obedience to God and service to others should be our primary concerns. We can talk, and we can certainly talk about that during discussion. This success orientation, especially to the unchurched to whom he ministers, could be interpreted as endorsing success as being wealth or power or status. He advertises that they have a very large and expensive cathedral, $1 million budget, the world's largest pipe organ, and so on. The celebrity guests are all self-made successes. Schuer is aware of the risk here on this question about success and is willing to continue. That's one comment that should be made. Secondly, there is danger perhaps in focusing really on this thing we call self-esteem. A seeker might totally become totally preoccupied, totally self-centered with the search for self-esteem. Remember, about 10 years ago, there was a whole cult of what I call the self-help cult in America. Remember the books, Looking Out for Number One, Power for Success, all these different ones that came out at that time. I'm sure by this time, B. Dalton bookstores are everywhere, and I have a very unscientific way of trying to figure out what the American people are preoccupied with. About 10 years ago, I noticed that in the B. Dalton bookstores, at least in the Twin Cities, that they had 5 merchandise items with self-help books, which I think said a good deal about things like Looking Out for Number One and Power for Success and all the rest. And the last time, about 3 weeks ago, I checked the B. Dalton at their flagship store, which is in Southdale Shopping Mall, And now they have 7 merchandise islands of computers, and only 2 on you know, self-help, which may indicate somewhere, something of the direction we're headed. But anyway, the self-help boom, you remember about 10 years ago. Many of these self-help themes were taken up by more Christian-oriented writers. And these self-help books, titles continue to sell well. Schuller seeks to build on this interest in the self. I'll come to that business about the world setting the agenda for the church in a little while, but that's what's happening here. Schuller recognizes first that self-esteem is basic to good mental health, happiness, no maturity. No argument there. Secondly, the emphasis on self-esteem can be a useful antidote to much of the self-negation that permeates American religious life. Things like sin, guilt, over and over again, that some of us, like see Terry there, we were talking about the other day, had to overcome, and you are guilty. Remember, this was heaped up on us in Bible camp all the way through. It takes a long time, you know, for some of us to work our way through this. There is forgiveness, there is affirmation. That's a second part. The third, Schuller preaches that the gospel is the ultimate resource for building self-esteem. The incarnation, God's acceptance of us, is the basis, he argues, for self-esteem. God loves us so that we can love ourselves. But that isn't all there is to it. It can, and for some other people, has come to focus very intensely on the self. Schuller talks about human needs, you know, fine. But the whole worldview of possibility, same thinking, you see, centers on self-esteem. A kind of self-satisfaction with the I'm okay, you're okay kind of approach. The Christian faith, I think it can be argued, is more than a vehicle for self-fulfillment and self-actualization. It calls for self-giving and self-giving of self and the forgetting of self. Carol Bart once remarked that the greatest freedom we can experience is freedom from the self, these mortal coils, getting rid of all that self-preoccupation all the time. Okay, next. It's possible, and some people have suggested, that Schuller has really more psychology than he has gospel in his message. What can we say to that? Schuller, his critics agree, is influenced by many schools in the field of psychology. And he is certainly not representative, of just one particular school. And he, furthermore, is something of a groundbreaker, a pioneer in seeking to understand here and bridge the gulf between psychology and religion. That has to be said, in an affirmative way. Something of a pioneer in bridging the gulf between psychology and religion, and looking for the common ground that both can share. Schuller does look for that common ground. Okay, doesn't, however, Schuller's system really, finally, in the last analysis, get down to self-help? The question is this. Let me phrase the question this way. When things go wrong, when things go really bad, when we know we are lost, is that due to what theology would call our pride, or our sin, if you like? Or is it due to some maladjusted psychological condition? Let me give an example here. This is a complicated one, but I'll go slow, but I want to be sure it's clear. When the biblical notion of willful human pride becomes the psychological equivalent of a defense mechanism to cover insecurity, there is, I think, cause for concern. I'll read that again. When the biblical notion of willful human pride becomes the psychological equivalent of a defense mechanism to cover insecurity, then there is cause for concern. Psychology tells us a great deal about the human condition, but it does not study the human condition in relation to God. It is inherently person-centered, not theocentric-centered. Let me say, I think it is easy, once one gets into possibility thinking, to make have too fuzzy a connection here between those two areas. Can it be said about Schuller that he's in that great American tradition of positive thinking, going way back to Ben Franklin? You remember, and following up, especially to Schuller's acknowledged mentor, Norman Vincent Peale. I like to, when I talk about this, to point to Benjamin Franklin. Everybody remembers Benjamin Franklin. I think he was sort of the beginning of self-help in America. Franklin, you remember, decided he wanted to improve his life, so he decided there were 13 virtues that he wanted to cultivate, and that he was going to practice intensively one each week, and once he had that one down, he was going to move on to virtue number 2 and virtue number 3 and 4 and so on, and he talks about this in his autobiography, and what he found was that by the time he got to virtue number 4, number 1 was beginning to slip again. But it set a tone in America that has lasted. There's a wonderful book, and I'd certainly recommend it for your parish library or for yourself. Donald Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R, is called The Positive Thinkers. Self-help in America from Franklin through Schuller. And it's really very well done. He used to teach at UCLA, so he had a good opportunity for observation there. But Donald Meyer, Westwood isn't that far from Orange County, but Donald Meyer, The Positive Thinkers, and he talks about... The idea, William James had the idea, Mary Baker had the idea, Remember our old friend Bruce, but here, I'd like to talk to seniors, Bruce Barton, the man nobody knows, does that ring a bell? One, just one, okay, he was 1920, so nobody would mind looking at that. But the idea that once you find the right formula on how to attack your personal problems and keep following that formula day in and day out, you can't help but succeed. The way to conquer your inner problems is through hard discipline, self-control, and repeating of the formula that you have. And certainly, I think that Schuller is in that tradition. He talks about getting positive ideas to lead us to positive actions. Life problems can be met with a positive, upbeat attitude. This gets things done. It moves mountains. It affects our bodies, and so on. And mind cure can help also. And here he is in, I think, good company. I was very impressed, and maybe some of you read the book about, what was it, about 5-6 years ago, Norman Cousins' book, Anatomy of an Illness. Does that ring a bell with anybody here, Anatomy of an Illness? When the editor of Saturday Review wasn't getting much help from the medical profession, and he decided simply to get as much laughter as possible. He brought in old candid camera tapes, and he read and so on, and it worked. And what was thousands of letters he got from people, testifying to the same kind of experience that they had had in their life. So what I'm trying to say by using the Norman Cousins example is that this isn't just something which doesn't have any basis in reality. I think there's something to be said for it, but up to a point.
Did you mention Norman Vincent Peale?
Norman Vincent Peale, just briefly here, right. Peale getting started with the power of positive thinking in 1952. And Peale comes out of the same Dutch Reform tradition. Marble Collegiate Church, good old 29th Street and Fifth Avenue is Dutch Reformed also. And like Peale, Schuller goes around and addresses salesmen's conventions also, right? They see no conflict there. All right. Now, but I would like to suggest there are a couple of potential weaknesses here that I'm going to point out. Is positive thinking an adequate perspective from which to really understand what's going on in our lives? We can control some things in our lives, but we know also we are caged in around by pressures and forces over which we have very little, if any, control. We have certain physiological limitations which can't be overcome or transcended by mind power. Schuller says, and I quote, "Whatever the mind can believe, the human being can achieve." He wants that as being an inspirational idea, but it could be misunderstood. As Christians, I think we accept the limitations of our creaturehood. We affirm our mortality. Here we know, we realize we are ultimately incapable of shaping our own destinies. Only God really does that. Secondly, I think by way of comment, by following positive thinking, we tend to avoid the negative aspects of life, or engage with it, if you like. Schuller says not to let the negative stifle the positive creative thoughts and actions. We should clean out negative thoughts as unwanted weeds, which crowd out positive thoughts and successes. He wants us to get rid of the word impossible. The possibility thinking, I think, can move us too quickly and too simply from an honest confrontation with the world, with the harsh realities of misery and meaninglessness. The Bible doesn't say we can eliminate the negative aspects of life, but presents, I think, a balanced picture of life with its unvarnished woes as well as its golden possibilities. Next, here's one thing I want to pick up on what we talked about before. Schuller's relation to what I would call the prevailing culture of the time, the values of our age. Church growth strategy there is founded on the principle that non-Christians should set the agenda for the world, for the church. Non-Christians, the world, if you like, should set the agenda for the church. Discover the cultural temple of the unchurched people. Go out and make a big inspiring impression on those non-church people, and they will come in. This is what he told the Church Growth Institute. But I think he's on thin ice in allowing the church, the culture, to set the agenda for the church. Because we know, I think, very often that the history of the church has been one of cultural captivity. Christians have eagerly embraced the values and standards of the world. When that happens, it cuts down on, oftentimes silences, the prophetic call to justice, to love, and humility before God. Schuller is quite confident, furthermore, that in his belief that God loves America best. He holds patriotic worship services for his congregation on the television programs. The TV program had an I Am an American Flag performance, very patriotic. Once in a while, he hangs an American flag over the whole ceiling of the cathedral. And everybody had a sing-along for the tunes of one of the American Armed Forces bands. Patriotism to him is fine, it's okay, and he lets it really go at that. But there are those critics who suggest that it can get to be something of a cultural idol. something that can replace the centrality of other kinds of worship in the congregation. There are those who argue that God really doesn't love America best. It took Billy Graham about 20 years to find that out, but he's, I think, there now. Schuller on this really is less clear. He also, I think, in talking about cultural captivity, identifies the Christian way with the American way in other areas. Certainly in what, you know, we call in economic terms laissez-faire or market or free enterprise capitalism. Very clear here, laissez-faire, market capitalism. And I quote, "You have a God-ordained right to be wealthy. You are a steward of the goods, the gold, the gifts that God has allowed to come into your hands. Having riches is no sin. Wealth is no crime. Christ did not praise poverty. The profit motive is not necessarily unchristian." Close quote on that. And I would suggest is it really proper to link the Christian faith with any such, you know, single economic system. Schuller firmly endorses the profit motive. You deserve what you earn. Self-esteem can be developed, Schuller argues, by success in business, in taking pride in one's job, in being evaluated the success, you see, by capitalistic standards. This will encourage people to want to do more, to broaden and deepen their contribution, because people will pay for what they want, and what they want is what is given to them, and thus they believe that they are doing a good thing and their self-esteem will rise. And like Peel, Schuller is heartily endorsed by the American business community. And I would suggest this may be letting the culture set the standards or the agendas for the church. we didn't even need a fire drill to you know, to get finished here sooner than I've done before. He is one of the most influential leaders in American religious life, and he's been so, as I've suggested, for over 15 years, and I'm sure will continue to be one. He has been a successful pre-evangelist who has learned to bring unchurched to within earshot of the gospel. He has been bold, imaginative, and to many inspiring, a major force in the continuing church growth movement, sharing with thousands his lessons learned at Garden Grove. Many would agree he has brought comfort and hope to millions. And I'll say this straight off as an example for my son. My son was finishing up in seminary in Connecticut, and he was facing a herniated disc, which was finally corrected by surgery. But beforehand, they tried, as some of you know, with the laminectomy. It's not the procedure I think it's used for herniated disc anyway. They like to get you on your back for about a month before they try surgery. At least this is what the orthopedic surgeon in New Haven did. And there isn't a whole lot you can do when you're on your back. Rick started listening to Schuller for the first time, and he said there were things with which he disagreed, but the thing that kept him listening to Schuller was hope. He didn't sometimes hear that from some of the other things. He had to believe, obviously, that the surgery was going to be successful as it was. But nevertheless, he has brought comfort and hope to millions. And my son, I should say, his, how should I say that otherwise, is not prone to be what you would call a cheerleader for the American Chamber of Commerce or the capitalist system of you know, business enterprise. Okay, but he has brought the comfort and hope to millions of people through his popular television ministry. So people will say, well, why argue with that? I think it can be charged that he promotes a message which oftentimes lacks depth and variety. Some people say he is a Johnny One-Noter who seldom varies his positivistic approach to the gospel. To reach the unchurched, he has, as some people say, softened the tensions and the puzzles which have existed within theology, between theology and psychology, between the church and culture, between the sacred and the secular. He has sought to blend these into a single whole, and he says he does this to avoid confusing those who are seeking. His song, so to speak, is one of soaring, blending harmonies, sort of everyone in union. But there are not only melodies, but I would suggest in conclusion there are, you know, arresting counter-melodies also. And I would like to stop there and see what happens, because I know there are some people who feel very strongly in favor of him and some people who have a speech or two to deliver on the other side. I would be happy to entertain and welcome your comments here. I see it's stuffy in here. Can anybody do anything about that? Yeah.
Now, I just wanted to comment on my sister belongs to a sister church of his in Los Alamitos.
Okay.
What is that, 20 miles from Garden Grove, and beautiful, nice big church. I forgot the name, it's a park, Highland Park, Flamingo Park, some park church. And anybody down there? But anyway, it does have the drive-in swells in the lawn, the speakers that go in the car, and then on the side of the three-story church, the windows. Slide back. There's a balcony out there so he can speak out there, but they're in terrible financial shape. They're just down the tube, almost. And I'm wondering if maybe a matter of geography, they're too close to Schuler.
He doesn't make mistakes, really, I don't think, and, you know, it's just like McDonald's, never too close to each other, or Burger King or some of the rest of these. I would be surprised if it was a matter of proximity. I would, maybe it's a matter of get a new board of trustees. I just, 20 miles.
They're between preachers now.
Yeah, between preachers, yeah. Heavy density, that could be a problem too, that
you really have to lose 20 miles.
And it could also be said, as I said before, Schuler doesn't have very many, you know, direct imitators, because for one, he has a national publicity, and maybe anybody who tries to imitate him out there will be compared unfavorably to what he's doing. In fact, this is one of the comments or the criticisms that's made of the television, or sometimes we call it the electronic church, is that if back in your parish, back in Kenyon or Hackensack or wherever it might be, people watch really spectacular pulpit preachers, we used to call them princes of the pulpit, and they come and hear an average, ordinary, routine kind of sermon, maybe they heard it, you know, two or three times before, and they've heard all the sermon illustrations, obviously the local parish is going to suffer by comparison. That's possible in that sense. Because Schuler has his style, his turf, so carefully defined that nobody else is going to, you know, try to touch it. I think that's possible. I saw here.
Two questions.
Sure.
Does he have a successor? And what about the conflict with the Internal Revenue?
Yes, thank you. Successor is clearly going to be a son. I don't think there's any real doubt about that. He's carrying on. In the great tradition, some people ask, is there a successor? What is he, in his early 60s, I think, Schuler? Somewhere in his early 60s, and he doesn't show any sign, I think, of slowing up at all. Incredible physical vitality that goes there. But I think his son, who does the sort of the number two stuff, you know, on the television program now, sometimes he introduces, you know, the guest celebrity for the week and all the rest. And the question came up about Internal Revenue. And I want to mention this, I did it at coffee with a couple. One reason I'm not altogether frightened over some of the money that some of the television celebrity preachers are getting is that our old friend Internal Revenue watches all of these people very, very carefully. Some of you remember a few years ago when Jim Baker with PTL, that's Praise the Lord, we used to call it a Pocket Testament League, Terry, remember that? Some people say it's Pass the Loot, but... but anyway... Yeah, LUTE, thank you. Sarcasm doesn't matter. But he had a fund for, I think it was foreign missions, and then when the money came in, he spent it for something else and got in a lot of trouble with Internal Revenue. And like with Reverend Moon, the argument that Baker has, and Baker has come out in favor of Reverend Moon, for instance, on this case that we talked about on Thursday, is that once the money gets there, it belongs to us, and the church has no right to tell people how it should be used. The church, I mean, the state has no right to tell people. State has no right to tell people, the church people how it should be used. Okay. And finally, Baker had to, readjust, and what he had to do was get some new CPAs to finally solve the problem there. They couldn't have somebody who has, you know, when you get off over 10, you take off your shoes and socks. And he had some people who didn't even have calculators. because they were cheaper. Anyway. Schuler uses the cathedral to be used for non-church or ecclesiastical kinds of events, concerts, lectures, and that sort of thing, for which admission was charged, and didn't pay the admission tax for this, and the Internal Revenue Service said that was a mistake, and they sued, and rather than fight it, all the way to the top. I think Schuler had bad advice on this. I think he needs a new attorney the way Baker needed a new accountant. I think it was $340,000, the figure sticks in my mind, and they decided to pay it. And now, if they are going to rent or lease whatever the cathedral, it'll be just the way you would do it for, is there such a thing as a Los Angeles arena or the Minneapolis auditorium or, you know, whatever it be, you would treat it in just that way and not as a church facility. But a lot of people want it to be there because they have what everybody in Minister in Southern California dreams of, they've got enough parking. You don't have anything else if you've got enough parking. Terry was talking about praying for a parking space to find one. You don't have to pray down in Garden Grove for enough parking places, they are there. Yeah, Terry.
Did did you happen to see that full-page cartoon by Conrad in the Los Angeles Times sometime after the Crystal Cathedral was built? Picture of the glass cathedral, and Schuller was in the pulpit holding forth, and up in the upper left-hand corner was a meteor heading for the church, and the caption was, "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone."
That's rough.
Well, his ideas about success and private enterprise and such, are they solely his, or are they from his church? I mean, the Dutch Reform or whatever.
They aren't denominational, let's put it that way. You can find, the support for the laissez-faire free market kind of capitalist approach in any of the major denominations in this country. And it doesn't belong simply to that. I think that simply depends on the value system, in this case, of the minister, and basically the congregation also. And you may find more in some denominations than in others. I don't imagine, I don't want to start picking on any, because that wouldn't be fair. There's so many variations here.
But, all those words sound like quotes right out of Amway, which comes out of Southern.
And he does, he addresses salesmen's, salespersons at conferences, right? And teaches them, as Peel does, teaches them sales techniques. Peel once was voted Salesman of the Year, and thought that was a compliment. And it's Amway, and there's another one too along with Amway. Does Tupperware get into the American Way sort of stuff the way Amway does? I don't know.
They don't come here.
Yeah. 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 Gets into that? Okay. And okay. That's a good question. Yes.
When you think about money being contributed to whatever, Schuller or Graham, or you think about people at home who are elderly or who are confined at home with their only outlet for church, and they send in their dollars or their $2 or whatever, what happens to that money?
I don't have the budget, but the budget itself is over $1 million. How many pastors are there at Crystal Cathedral? There are several, and they have full programs. This is one thing that's not often mentioned. Once you become interested, then there are things, serious things, like Bethel Bible Series for people who are there. You get over the sort of the unchurched kind of emphasis before, and all the people that I've talked to who have been there say there is a very sort of traditional conservative bent to responsible kind of theology that's being done for the church members. But that's not what the general people, and what I'm saying was money, I'm sure that takes a lot of money. I can't imagine with anybody with a celebrity status like that, the same thing is true with Graham, that there would be any, unnecessarily large salary given to
any of them. That is my point, exactly. Oh. In the case of this church that's supposed to be, why can't they have a form of missions and say, okay, we'll donate a little bit there, we'll donate a little bit here?
Seed money, I suppose you could say. He likes to have, for one of his promos, he likes to send out mustard seeds, in plastic case. What they want to do is get your name on the mailing list.
That's right.
And, Gertrude.
I remember when the Wolves were here, and they talked about how difficult it was to serve the parish that was very near them.
Yeah.
And that they're the ones that take care of the neighborhood. They have to do very gimmicky things in order to counteract what Schuller does. And also one of the things was that where Lutherans disagree is that he emphasizes the power of glory, where Lutherans express the power of the cross.
Right.
And most importantly in our lives.
Right.
And he does not have that symbolism in his cathedral because it's controversial.
Yeah, if any of you have been here during the time of John Schramm's period here, you come away knowing, if nothing else, the difference between the theology of glory and the theology of the cross. Remember, last year we heard, you and I sat together and heard John's stirring sermon on that. I've never seen, John was pretty exercised that day. John doesn't like the idea that I talked about before, with Jesus every day is nice. In fact, that's one of the titles of one of the chapters in Mary's book on the gifts of grace. And she and John, and I think sometimes that's the impression I was trying, sometimes that's the impression given, I think, by Schuller, is that sometimes, with Jesus every day is nice, and that's the theology of glory. We're bound for glory land, instead of the theology of the cross, the renunciation kind of approach. And that's not attractive, that's right, and makes discipleship a great deal more difficult. I hope to have more, so somebody would really disagree. Who was here at the Church Growth Institute? Was there somebody, did I lose them at the fire drill?
Yeah.
You only found out he had a point, he preacher, so he wouldn't be afraid of talking. Anybody else? There's always more. Yeah.
I heard him a few years ago when he was discussing with a pastor's group his whole program and method. And I think there were a lot of criticisms. I think some of us came through very disappointed in his theology and his message. But I think a lot of us came out saying, however much we may criticize the content of his theology, we better pause until we get that much of a concern for people who are outside of the church. You may say anything you want about him, but he at least started with a real concern for that.
Yeah, that's a source of tension that'll never go away in any kind of congregation, is that the congregation can get to be kind of a clubby thing where it's the same people doing the same things, and you know, you get to rely on, you know, certain people. Who was it? Phyllis Swanson back in St. Peter's when I belonged there. Phyllis would do anything, and you know, that you, the pastor asked her to, and it got to be almost a temptation to, you know, call on Phyllis to do this because she really wanted to and did it, always did it well. And you knew it would be done well, and you knew it would be done on time. But as a result, there are a lot of others who simply said, you know what, instead of leaving it to George, we'll leave it to Phyllis. And that's always a source of tension. And with the great mobility we have, what is it, Americans, 20% of the American public moves every year, isn't it, some incredible figure like that? You're going to have, you know, large turnovers, even the smaller towns, you're going to have large turnovers, and, you know, and how many people come in and go out with never having really been, you know, engaged in the church. I like where I am now. When you join the church, the first thing they do is get you in a committee, not necessarily just in a committee, but to get you doing something concrete right away, with the idea being that you're expected to do something and not just come as a spectator. And isn't it in Minneapolis, if I'm not mistaken, with Mount Olivet, that they have such a strong, you know, sort of alert program that if a family moves in that general South Minneapolis area around St. James, within 24 hours, there's a member of Mount Olivet there visiting the people. I think that's basically. You usually have something from Mount Olivet. All right, well, you've got 12,000 members, you can do it. But that's the sort of thing that I think you're talking about that can be done to reach other people. Yeah. And everybody says they learn from Schuler's, you know, programs. Right. Anything else? Yeah, one, sure.
What does he preach to the poor as far as, you know?
These poor is as much a state of mind as anything else. It's the old, remember, who was it, Russell Conwell turn, there's diamonds in your backyard. Wasn't that the old one? There's diamonds in your backyard. That was a famous self-help speech that caught on in this country. And that you just haven't realized all your possibilities yet.
Your comment about the wealth, though, I guess I'm wondering, what's the biblical basis
there? Well, Billy Graham says the same thing. Jesus never criticized the wealthy people for being wealthy. It's what you do with the wealth. Remember the business about the rich young ruler, what must I do to be saved? And I love that King James term. After he was told what he must be doing, he went away sorrowfully sad. That is so beautifully packed, understated, sorrowfully sad. Marvelous insight there. But that's Graham says this too, it's what you do with your wealth. But then there are the Beatitudes, but poor and the oppressed and the weak, and that is sort of thing also. But this is what you find in the Donald Meyer book. And what I refer everybody to, you know, he talks about this. Yeah, and then of course this idea catches on too. There are all kinds of groups. Reverend Ike, does that bring up whether you got one to be rich and so on and so forth. God also wants you to have lunch, so let's split.